And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
And welcome, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. It's great to be with you today, and you have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, where we practice our throwdown moves on how to explain, defend, share the faith with charity, clarity, and confidence. And I hope everybody had a great weekend. I certainly did myself, and but you know what? It's good to be back in the dojo. You know, it's good to kind of get back in the swing of things and focus once again for our 1 hour program on, you know, learning about how to share, defend, explain the faith, learn about the faith, love the faith, and help others love it as well. Fantastic show in store for you today. Master Apologist Michael Aquilina is coming into the dojo. We've had him a couple of times before, and I wish I could have him more because he is just a storehouse of information. And he's also just a colorful commentator and just all-around great guy. And he's going to talk about the early church fathers. Now, you're probably thinking, all right, well, Mike Aquilina, he is the guy when it comes to early church. Well, he's got a new book. It's called Villains of the Early Church. So we can look at the dark side of the early church and look at the bad guys, the guys with the black cowboy hats that are, you know, you'll find in history, but, you know, they're normally not really focused on. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Just filling out, you know, getting a complete picture of early church and, you know, the Catholic Church in its early years. And always we're going to have our critical thinking skills, and that we do that through a segment that we have every show called Finding the Fallacy. And today's Finding the Fallacy is the poo-poo fallacy. The poo-poo fallacy. Yeah, you heard that correctly. That's one of its names. And also we meet one of the early church fathers today, and actually today's early church father is none other than a local council of the church, is the Council of Elvira. So, yeah, not the song, but the council. So we're going to talk about that. And, all you know, as always, if you have any comments, questions, especially for our guest, Michael Aquilina, give us a call at the other side of the first break at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. And also, you can send us your questions. Maybe you don't want to go on the air, but maybe you want to share. Maybe there's an objection somebody threw out at you that you're not really sure how to handle. Maybe you're in a situation that you're not really, you know, you want to share. Maybe it's going good. Maybe it's not going well. Shoot us an email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. That goes through the internet to the dojo mailbox, and I do, by the way, answer all of them, and sometimes I even do a show. And, well, it's time for our shout-outs. I would like to welcome everybody watching on social media, on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Hey, you know what's really cool about the chat room is that as I turn to the dojo section or the social media section of the dojo, I noticed there's a lot of new names, and that means, hey, we are, word's getting out about Virgin Most Powerful, word's getting out about Hands-On Apologetics, and I really do appreciate all of you sharing, you know, liking, subscribing, letting people know about Hands-On Apologetics, because it's really great information that I think would be helpful for people had they known that it's available, not only live through all the wonderful radio stations that carry Virgin Most Powerful Radio, but also, you know, you can listen to it via the virginmostpowerfulradio.org website, or you can watch it on social media, Facebook and YouTube. So, yes, spread the word, you know. When I first started the show, we were just breaking 1K in subscriptions on YouTube. And today I just noticed that we're up to 3.25K. So we're moving. And it's all because of you. So thank you so much for your support. Tell everybody about Hands On Apologetics and Virgin Most Powerful. We appreciate it. All right. Well, without further ado, folks. Oh, by the way, Hector, like the emoji explosion. It's with sunglasses. You know, that obviously you're not in Michigan. Let's jump to our Finding the Fallacy, shall we? And like I said, the Finding the Fallacy today has a funny name. It's a poo-poo fallacy. And the poo-poo fallacy is informal logic that consists in dismissing an argument as being unworthy of serious consideration. Scholars generally categorize the fallacy as a rhetorical device in which the speaker ridicules an argument without responding to the substance of the argument. And, you know, just think of this occurs a lot in apologetics. If you're a debate junkie, like I at least used to be, I'm a recovering debate junkie. In debates, it is so common to have somebody say, one person will propose an argument, and then the response will be, oh, this is trotting out the same old arguments, the same old claims. And really, that is the poo-poo fallacy, because what it does is it's sending a social cue to the audience saying, okay, folks, nothing's going on here, nothing to observe, you know, move on. It's not worthy of serious consideration. Or sometimes, especially on social media, you have people who mock, ridicule, make fun of arguments, but they don't actually refute the arguments. They poo-poo it, in other words. So, you know, whenever I see this fallacy, the image that comes to my mind is, you know, the Irish beat cop, you know, that's standing in front of a burning building telling everybody, there's nothing to see here, nothing to see. Keep moving on. That's essentially what the poo-poo fallacy is. So that is our fallacy for today. And, yeah, keep it in mind. So next time someone tries to dismiss your arguments by maybe making fun of them, or just, you know, characterizing them as, you know, just more of the same, yada, 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 point out that that's not exactly refuting the argument. All right, so why don't we learn a little bit about the early church, shall we, with our Meet the Early Church Fathers segment. And today's early church fathers, actually Council of the Church, the Council of Elvira, that read somewhere around 300 A.D., the city of Elvira was at or near the site of the present city of Granada in Spain. It consisted of 19 bishops, including the celebrated Osius of Cordova. And, all of them were present, along with 26 priests and deacons. And the council was more of a reform nature, and it had a large part of its 81 canons. Wow, a lot of canons. 81 canons. Of its decree reflected legislation from African origin. And like I said, the council, scholars are not really sure exactly when it met, probably the best date somewhere between 300 and 306 AD. Let's see. The canons are interesting because they're all disciplinary. So there isn't really any doctrinal stuff. However, it does throw light on religious and ecclesiastical practices in Spanish Christianity right on the eve of the triumph of Christianity in Spain. So these canons deal with marriage, baptism, idolatry, fasting, excommunication, cemeteries, vigils, the frequentation of mass, the relations of Christians with pagans, Jews, and heretics. There are some... a couple of canons that have garnered a lot of attention. For example, Canon 33 is the oldest positive ecclesiastical ordinance concerning the celibacy of the clergy. Canon 13 exhibits the institution of nuns, which was actually predated the council by a long time, but we actually have legislation concerning nuns. Also in Canon 36, we have one of the canons that is often disputed in apologetics, and that is it appears to forbid the use of images. And probably the best way to understand it, and this is by some great theologians like DeRossi and Heffel, is that the reason why this particular canon urges against the veneration of images as practiced in the Catholic Church, that this prohibition is directed against the use of images in underground churches only. Because, like I said, you know, this is during a time where it's right on the eve of the triumph of Christianity in Spain. So Christianity still was very much underground religion. It still was fighting against pagans in terms of beliefs and practices. And so, you know, there is a lot of, you know, need for Christians to kind of, I guess, circle the wagons, you could say, and make sure that their practices don't kind of slip into other practices. So anyway, these great Catholic theologians say that this prohibition is directed against the use of images in the underground churches only, lest the pagans should caricature sacred scenes and ideas. In other words, that pagans who, you know, if it was in public churches, they could maybe take these images and use them for insert them into their own pagan beliefs. So that is the canons of the Council of Elvira from Spain, like I said, roughly around AD 300. And yeah, that's a fascinating council. Like I said, it's all disciplinary, and it is cool because if you read these canons, folks, it gives you a little bit of a snapshot into the life of the church in Spain at this early date. All right, coming up on the other side of the break, Master Apologist Michael Aquilina is coming on board, and we're going to talk about the villains of the early church. We talked about the councils, now let's talk about the villains. Listen to Hands on Apologetics, I'm Gary Machida. We'll be right back.
This is Jesse Romero.
And I'm Terry Barber.
From the Terry and Jesse Show. And we invite you to listen to the Holy Hour of Power, High Energy Catholic Radio. We're two Catholics with a PhD in common sense. We're on Monday through Friday on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
What we're going to give you is masculine Catholic teachings on the faith. You know, we say we're too inspired to be tired, we're too protected to be dejected, and we're too renewed to be subdued. Why? Because we believe in Jesus Christ and His bride, the church. And we will take each issue of the day and show you how the Catholic Church has the answer for our culture. What we really do is bring men back into the Catholic Church, which it's about time to do. We want men to be leaders in their Catholic faith so that they can bring their family to heaven.
Our program is not right versus left, it's right versus wrong. And our program is where Catholicism and culture intersect. It's High Energy Catholic Radio.
We're going to inspire you to fall deeper in love with Jesus Christ and His bride, the church.
The Terry and Jesse Show on the Virgin Most Powerful app.
Hi, this is Eddie Chavez, host of Jesus 911. I want to take this opportunity to let you, our listeners, know about an event being held here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina. We will be celebrating the Feast of St. Michael the Archangel on September 28th, 2019, beginning at 9 o'clock with Mass in the morning and talks to follow. Ruben Nava and myself will be speaking, so come and hear us talk about St. Michael and Our Lady. Come join us, and we'll see you there.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. And as every episode, we talk about the early church fathers. Today we looked at the Council of Elvira. It's always good to know the early church, because when you're explaining, defending the faith, many times questions come down to, well, how do you know that Christ and his apostles believed and taught something? So you need to know the early church so you can point out, you know, there's historical evidence for what we believe. And usually the focus is on early church fathers, you know, the saints or near saints that wrote from the time of the apostles to the 8th century. But there's a flip side, and this I can't wait to talk with our guest, because there's a flip side. There's also the villains of the early church, and to help us work through these the villainy within the early church is Mike Aquilina. Mike is a Catholic author, popular speaker, poet, songwriter, who serves as the executive vice president for St. Paul Center of Biblical Theology. He's a contributing editor to Angelus News, and he's the author of over 50 books, including Fathers of the Early Church, The Mass of the Early Christians, and also Church. And his website, is fathersofthechurch.com. All one word, fathersofthechurch.com. And Mike Aquilina, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Gary.
It's always a joy to have you on the program. You are such a wealth of information.
Well, thank you. I love history. I'm a history buff, and I like sharing entertaining stories. So I'm kind of in awe, because I can probably reach behind me and grab my Gary Machuda books. I always keep them close at hand, and of course it's intimidating being interviewed by one of your heroes. So
Well, thank you. That's so nice. But you know what? I don't have enough shelf space for your books. That's got to be in the other room. So the feeling is mutual. Let's talk about, where did you come up with the idea for villains of the early church? I love that idea.
Well, because there were so many of them. Whenever you have great exercises of virtue, whenever you have great heroes emerging, they're often appearing in opposition to villains, okay? Yeah. Watch any animated, have a hero, you're going to have a villain. And the early church, the story of the early church is rich in its number of heroes, the saints. Yeah. But also, it's pretty full of villains. There were those like the persecutors and the heretics who really worked their best mischief or their worst mischief against the saints, against the church.
Yeah. Yeah, I love looking at it from that perspective, because it's normally think in terms of, you know, the guys with the white hats. That actually, you know, the same is true in the New Testament. The same is true in the New Testament, right? There's villains in the New Testament as well.
A couple of my first chapters are devoted to those New Testament villains, men like Pilate and Caiaphas, and really the arch villain of all Christian history, Judas.
Yeah, right.
But it's serious business dealing with these guys in real time. Just like in our lives, when people want to get in our face, when people want to work mischief in our lives, it's serious business. 50 years from now, maybe, if we're still alive, we'll laugh about it and we'll see how they made fools of themselves. We'll see that the things they did just exposed their villainy to ridicule. But when you're dealing with it in real time, it's not so funny. One thing that we have the leisure of doing is finding the humor in those situations from 1500 years ago, because we don't have to deal with the problems that they made. We can just look back at them and see that often they were as comical as the cartoon villains that we meet on Saturday morning, when we were kids, watching Simon Bar Sinister or Wile E. Coyote. These ancient villains did absurd things and really caused themselves more trouble than they caused any of the Christians.
It reminds me of, I was dropping my 6-year-old, this was a long time ago, off for soccer practice, and she turns to me and says, "I can't go, Lisa's there." And I said, "Who's Lisa?" She goes, "That's my arch nemesis." And like now I can look back and just, you know, she was so serious, but now I bet she would really roll her eyes.
Oh yeah, sure. And in another 20 years, it'll be even funnier. So we have a good 1500, 1800 years between us and the death of these villains. So we can look back and see that they often did things that were very silly and they made fools of themselves. Whereas their victims went on to glory and are honored by all of history.
Yeah. That's a great point. And something to keep in mind too, you know, is when we run into, you know, people who oppose us, oppose the faith, you know, it's ultimately, you know, in the stream of things, if you keep yourself righteous and do what's right, you're going to make out okay. And those who don't, you know, they're kind of going to be ending up on somebody's bookshelf, you know, collecting dust and people won't even remember their names.
Well, what's interesting about these guys and their interactions with the saints is that we look back now and we can't imagine our story without them, because they were often the ones whose deeds called forth the witness of the saints. You know, this Christian might have been just living his life below the radar, trying to have a quiet existence in his home, when all of a sudden he sees there's this intolerable situation out there that's caused by a certain villain who's upsetting the social order or the ecclesiastical order. And suddenly this guy's called to stand up and be a hero. And then the villain helps him along by putting out his best arguments. And the saint has to sharpen his arguments against the steel of those other arguments. And so we find the saints becoming more saintly, becoming more holy, becoming more wise because of the opposition of the villains. You know, when bad things happen to good people, they're actually good things because they really help us to grow in holiness.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, why don't we start with what's an early villain in the early church? Who would you put right after the time of the New Testament?
Right after the time of the New Testament. Well, one of them is actually a crossover villain, because we encounter him in the Acts of the Apostles. He's a real historical figure whom we encounter in the Acts of the Apostles. And yet there's so much that documents his life after that. And that's Simon Magus. Yeah. Okay. This man who's a Samaritan, right? He's living in Samaria, and he encounters the apostles, and he sees that they're wonder workers. And he himself is an amateur wonder worker. He's known as a magus. He's known as a magician. So he likes to make spectacles. And he sees what the apostles can do, right? And Simon is a convert. He's one of their converts. And he sees what they can do when they lay hands on people. Those people are filled with the Holy Spirit, and those people are inspired literally to do great deeds. And he says, hey, how much do I have to pay you to get that power you have, right? Yeah. And he's chastised for saying that. And he's told, you know, that this is about the most hellish thing that you could propose. And so he repents there. Well, we find later on, you know, from the post-apostolic witness, that Simon did a little backsliding from his repentance. And, you know, he decided that he wanted that apostolic limelight after all. And he wanted to be the Christian sort of wonder worker, the Christian sort of magus, magician. And so he started concocting a very strange cosmology. And we'll recognize it because it really gets legs and it goes on the run. And we later call it Gnosticism. He's proposing to sell you, you know, for the right price, a certain kind of knowledge that will take you beyond even what these Christian apostles are offering you. And we could be sure, because he was a magician, that he always accompanied his preaching with great signs, you know, spectacles, illusions, you know, the way a magician might do it today. He had a partner. Her name was Helen. He was very much taken with her, but he proposed her as a goddess. And he stole motifs from Christianity, just the way the later Gnostics would do, and he put that false teaching out there. And he made it all the way to Rome, you know, putting his false teaching out there in competition with the real apostles. Who ends up in Rome? Peter and Paul. We know that, right, from the Acts of the Apostles, that that's their trajectory of their lives. And we know from later in the New Testament that they made it there. Simon made it there, too. They both wanted to be in, they all wanted to be in the big time. They wanted to reach the most people. Peter and Paul for good purposes, Simon probably for money. He made it, and there he won many converts, but we're told that he was kind of a parasite on the body of the church. He didn't go out and try to evangelize pagans. He really tried to steal Christians away, offering them something more, you know, that they're not offering you, something they're hiding from you.
Yeah, interesting. So so how does it end up with Simon? That's a fascinating history because, yeah, we're familiar with Acts, and he just – it actually doesn't end too bad. Like you said, he kind of repents and, you know, and moves on. You don't hear from him. But then he makes this cottage industry of, you know, kind of like Christianity plus magic and a little bit of paganism. So how what is his final end? What happens?
Well, he gets to Rome and he lives out his own little prosperity gospel, okay? He finds some rich patrons who are willing to, you know, put him up in their mansions, and he gets platform because of them. You know, so he's stealing these wealthy patrons away from the church, you know, offering them something more, a little something to satisfy their vanity, maybe. Peter is warned about this, and Peter goes to have a showdown with them. Well, Peter actually has several showdowns with them. They always end badly, but Simon doesn't end his lesson. It doesn't learn his lesson. And, you know, at one point he breaks his leg in several places because he's trying to work tricks against Peter. And anyway, this goes on. Peter always wins. It's just like a Warner Brothers cartoon, you know, when you read these accounts from the
Wile E. Coyote, rock comes down, right?
And it always ends that way. So finally, he must have had some tricks up his sleeve, but he told his followers that if they buried him alive, he would rise again on the third day. And so they buried him alive, and you know what? He's still there.
Wow, that he would have been better with you know, pick a card, you know, and bury me alive, and I'll prove to you. Wow, yeah. So, and he was seen kind of like as the ultimate arch heretic, wasn't he? From like all heresies kind of flow from, you know, his mischievous.
That's right. When you reach the later apologists and the anti-heresy fathers like Justin and Irenaeus and Hippolytus, they mention Simon as the progenitor of all the later heresies. Yeah. He's the one who kind of introduced Gnosticism into the bloodstream of Christianity, you know, and it was hard to eradicate after that.
Yeah, very good. We're chatting with Michael Aquilina about villains of the early church. More to come on the other side of the break, folks. Stay tuned.
Welcome to our January 11th, 2020 Spiritual Warfare Conference. Every year without fail, this is our most popular, well-attended event. This year's Spiritual Warfare Conference will host Adam Bly, a Catholic demonologist and an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists, along with Dr. Luis Sandoval, a psychiatrist who's part of the Healing, Deliverance, and Exorcism team for the Diocese of Orange. These two gentlemen bring tons of experience and expertise in the area of spiritual warfare. This is going to be a high-information Catholic seminar. I'll be there as well, sharing some riveting stories on the diabolical and liberation found through Jesus Christ, from my best-selling book, The Devil in the City of Angels. Mark your calendars, come and join us, and meet other radio hosts from Jesus 911. Contrary to popular belief, spiritual warfare is not demon-centered, it's Christ-centered. Come join us and learn how to armor up and fight the good fight of faith. Catholics, wake up. Don't hit the snooze button. Join us at St. Christopher Catholic Church, 629 South Glendora Avenue, West Covina, California, on January 11, 2020. See you then. Strength and honor in Jesus' name.
Sirach 11:24 says, "Do not say, 'I am self-sufficient. What harm can come to me now?'" According to St. Catherine of Siena, presumption is like vermin burrowing at the root of the tree of our soul. If we do not uproot it with great care and humility, it will eventually destroy the soul. May God keep us from all presumption of mind and heart, and realize that we depend on Him for everything.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We are chatting with Master Apologist Michael Aquilina on his book, Villains of the Early Church. And so we're looking at, you're familiar with church history, you're familiar with the early church fathers, but what about the flip side of villains and the early church? And Michael, are you there? Okay.
I am.
Aha, yes. So, you know, it's kind of funny. There is a comical aspect to, you know, the futility of these villains because no matter how hard they try, ultimately it fails, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And you know, the gates of hell will not prevail. They might seem to prevail for some time. And you know, one of the villains I deal with is one of the great persecutors, the Emperor Nero. And Nero, of course, launched the first large-scale persecution of the church. It seems there were other forays into this area. You know, Claudius probably had had some Christians arrested because of riots with the Jews in Rome during his reign. But Nero was the one who really touched off the first large-scale one and provided the legal precedent for the later persecutions, which were quite extensive, you know, and involved the deaths of tens of thousands of people. Right. So Nero is a significant figure, but like the others, he's fairly comical at this distance. He was a really warped man, perverse in many ways, you know, with the strangest sexual predilections. It's hard to imagine a taboo that, you know, at least from the Christian's perspective, it's hard to imagine that there were taboos he didn't transgress. And even for the Romans, and the Romans didn't exactly have high standards in this area, but he even appalled them by his behavior. But you know, he went after the Christians and he was a great threat to them. He launched the Great Persecution in 64 AD. So we're talking about just 30 years after Pentecost. The church is still very young, and he's establishing the Roman precedent for later persecutions. It's a scary thing, and he's a scary man. Many Christians believed him to be literally the Antichrist, okay? That he was the one that John was warning them about, you know, and that who was expected to come. This would persist for many centuries. Christians would expect the return of Nero, you know, when the Antichrist, you know, made his appearance. That it would be Nero who returned to Earth. There was a great fear of this. So Nero was another one of these figures. But again, when we look at his life now, he's ridiculous. He's a pig, you know, and it's kind of a joke, you know. He buys the affection of the people by making life in Rome a constant party. You know, he's constantly giving them free food, free booze, free entertainment on a grand scale, and killing people for their amusement. And they like him as long as that's going on. And he's appealing to the lower classes. The aristocracy had no use for him, so then he had no use for the aristocracy. But it must have been scary while he was alive. You know, there was great relief, I'm sure, and some level of rejoicing when the man died.
Yeah. Now, was he the one who accused Christians of setting fire to Rome?
Yes. And it's quite likely that he himself was the origin of the fire, because it was well known that he wanted to build himself a grand palace. The palaces that were already standing weren't big enough for him. So he planned to build one that was bigger for himself. And sure enough, not long after the fire, well, what do you know? He starts to look at all that burned area of the city. Well, he demolishes all the ruins of those houses, the houses of the poor and the middle classes, and he starts to build his palace there. We can still visit that palace today, the Domus Aurea, because it really became the focus of everyone's hatred for Nero. The Romans, who despised Nero, you know, saw that palace, which was, you know, adorned with gold. That's what Domus Aurea means, the gold house, the golden house. And they buried it in his time. So we can still visit it today, and it's mostly still intact because they just buried it. They wanted nothing to do with it. They didn't want to be reminded of it. But anyway, yes, he blamed the Christians because you don't do things like that and just get away with it, right?
Right.
You need a scapegoat. You know, people start to mumble and people start to grumble. And that's as an emperor, that's when you start to worry, because very few of the emperors died peacefully in their beds. Most of them died murdered, assassinated by their closest kin or their guards, actually.
Yeah. Do we know anybody that died under the Neronian persecution?
Peter and Paul, some pretty big names. Okay. Peter and Paul. But what's interesting is we observe the Feast of the Roman Martyrs every year on the day after the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul, and we don't know the names of any of those martyrs. All we know is their great witness and how it fortified the church, and it really did establish a model of fortitude for all the decades that followed, all the generations that followed, and we still look to it today.
Yeah, in fact, you know, him scapegoating the Christians, actually, that kind of backfired in that the populace started having much more sympathy for Christians because of how cruelly he was treating these people that they knew were more or less a scapegoat.
Yes, Tacitus tells us that. We have a pagan witness to that fact, and he was alive at that time. He tells, and you have to understand, Tacitus had no use for the Christians. He didn't like us. But he had to admit that Nero was a pig, and that these persecutions that Nero launched really did not work to his advantage. In fact, they really did create sympathy for the Christians among the populace.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so, boy, we have some big names, don't we? Simon Magnus and then yeah. Nero. And we haven't even crossed the end of the first century, right?
I mean, that's right.
This is just the very beginning of the early church. We got a couple minutes. Maybe we could fit one more in before the break.
Well, one guy I always think about in connection with you is Marcion, right? Because let me unplug my phone. I forgot to do that before. But Marcion is really the reason we have a canon, because he was a heretic of the middle of the 100s who wanted to tailor Christianity to his own doctrine that he preferred, and so he came up with his own canon. And in response, the Christian Church, the Catholic Church, had to say no, not the way he did it. This is the way you do it. And really, the earliest canon we have, the Muratorian Canon, was drafted in the 100s in response to Marcion's canon.
Yeah, that's a great example of how these villains actually, like you said, not only push the early church to holiness, but also crystallize their thoughts and their arguments, isn't it?
And there's often money involved. Marcion was a fabulously wealthy man. He was a shipbuilder. I often compare him to George Steinbrenner, if you can remember, the guy
who bought
the Yankees, right? And he really changed the way baseball was played, right? He had enough money that he said, "Watch me. I'll show you how to make a championship team. You buy it, right?" Yeah. Well, Marcion wanted to buy the Catholic Church and run it himself, and he almost succeeded.
So what was his background? Was he a convert to Christianity?
He was the son of a bishop, you know.
Oh, really?
At that time, yeah, the clergy were sometimes chosen from married men who would then live celibacy. And it's according to what the church fathers tell us, his own father excommunicated him because of immorality. But Marcion still thought that he should be an authority in the church like his daddy was. And so he went and he tried to buy that authority. Well, he didn't succeed.
Yeah.
But he did succeed to a degree that the church itself considered dangerous.
Right. Yeah. And like you said, you know, that provoked consideration for, okay, since he's denying certain New Testament books, then we really need to reaffirm what we've always held in regard to, you know, sacred scripture, especially New Testament sacred scripture.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Well, Marcion did have some success there, and he was, and we're told by Cyril of Jerusalem that there were still Marcionite churches in Jerusalem more than 200 years after Marcion's death.
Mm. Do we know how he died? What was his ultimate fate?
What's interesting about him is that according to the fathers, he tried to repent, and the church told him his absolution was conditional on his writing what he had made wrong, and he died before he could pull that off. So we don't know his ultimate fate, but we know, there's historical evidence that he at least made a movement in the right direction at the end. He just couldn't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Oh yeah, yeah. And that's a great lesson in history too. Is that sometimes the initial reaction when you want to make a boom, you regret it. You can't, like you said, put the toothpaste back in because your ideas have already spread. And,
yes.
And it takes a long time for his followers to kind of disappear.
That's right.
Roughly, when do Marcionites kind of disappear? Do you know?
You know, we don't hear much of them after the 4th century. You know, so by the end of the 4th century, I think it had pretty much vanished. I'm told that it mutated into other heresies later on. And of course, there were Marcion was another one of these Gnostic heretics, those who emphasized knowledge and thought that matter was evil and that there was a force opposed to God that was equal to God. There was the force of light and the force of darkness. So Marcion was Gnostic in many ways. He bore all the characteristics of a Gnostic religion. There were many varieties of Gnosticism that appeared concurrently with Marcion, but also later on. So he got plenty of competition, even among his fellow heretics.
Yeah. Yeah. And that affects how he, when he went to scripture, the books that seem to emphasize things like, you know, the virgin birth, you know, suffering in the flesh, that type of stuff. Yeah, you know, he kind of wished to get rid of it and focus on other texts.
That's right.
Very good. Well, we're chatting with Mike Aquilina about the villains of the early church. More to come on the other side of the break. You listen to Hands On Apologetics. We'll be right back.
Ernesto from Long Beach.
You know, I just wanted to comment, you know, and I just wanted to thank you guys. And I kind of wanted to encourage people that are listening, maybe that are not donating, you know, because honestly, I got to be honest, I used to think you guys were a little
too over the top,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If you
That's
know,
right.
If God gave us a lot, you know, and I have the blessing of listening to all this, I just want to call all the people, you know, I got 5 kids, you know, and I don't make a lot of money, and I'm still donating to you guys.
God bless you, brother. You're amazing.
We have to do this. We have to do the extra. And it's not even the extra. People see it like it's extra. Kneeling for communion, saying your rosary, saying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. It is not extra. It's what the church tells us to do.
Amen. You're a good man, brother.
30 years old, 29 years old, 5 kids, and I thank you guys. But everybody else, man, get on fire. Fight for the truth, man. I know what I'm telling you guys. There's
I
so
love it.
Out there.
In Luke 7, Jesus said, "I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven her, because she has been shown great love." According to St. John of the Cross, Christians should always remember that the value of their good works is not based on number and excellence. Their value is based on the love for God that prompts them to do the works. May we always be motivated by true love for God and not worry so much about what we do, but why we do it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. And we're chatting with none other than Mike Aquilina about the villains of the early church. And, Mike, you know, it's always scary when someone says, I'm thinking about this heretic, and I always think of you. But, you know, Marcion, I can see that, as long as it's not Arius or, you know, something like that.
Well, he did play a key role in the development of the canon. As I said before, you know, it's when we're challenged that we're forced to clarify what we mean and make our arguments tighter and stronger. So St. Augustine said that this is the reason why God allows heresy, because you know what? Most of the time we're lazy and we don't sharpen our arguments. We don't strengthen our knowledge. We don't do the things that we really should be doing until we're motivated to do them. So the heretics really do press us on. And Marcion did that for the church. He really did press us to define what we mean about our relationship with the Old Testament and really what we consider the Gospels to be. You know, he had only one Gospel, St. Luke's, and it was an edited version of St. Luke, because he didn't want to seem to be affirming the Old Testament at all. Marcion believed that the Old Testament God was a bad God, a second-tier God, a rebel God, who was opposed to his God, Marcion's God, who was the God, he said, of the New Testament. Well, the church had always believed, even in the year 140, that this is baloney. You know, this is contrary to what the apostles were telling us. We baptize in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and we recognize that formula as defining a relationship with the God of the Old Testament, who is the same God who redeemed us in the New.
Yeah, very good. So, Marcion, okay, I can guess on a couple of villains.
Well, there are a lot of others. Valentinus is another one from that time. And he was another one of these figures who seem comical right now. But you know what? Even in his own day, you had Irenaeus, who wrote the funniest passage in his book Against the Heresies as a spoof of Valentinus's doctrine. Because, really? You know, Valentinus just invented emanations, right? He needed to demonstrate that the real God was above the God of the Old Testament, right? He's doing the same thing Marcion had done, right? Mm. So he needs to demonstrate that, but he needs to have that God somehow interact with those of us who are separated from him. Yeah. So he needs to produce emanations from that God. And then the emanations produce emanations. And then the emanations, those further emanations, produce even further emanations. And this goes on. I suspect that this was going on even in the time of St. Paul, and that's why he talks about these genealogies. He never talks about what they are, but in a couple of places, he condemns the use of spiritual genealogies. Well, you know, that's what was going on in Valentinus's work. And Irenaeus just took the writings of Valentinus and he replaced the names, because Valentinus would give high-sounding names to the emanations, right? So we would be in awe of them. We would be impressed by them. We would think that they sounded smart, right? Because they had these these foreign academic sounding names. Well, Irenaeus just went through and said, well, you know what? The terminology doesn't matter. Let's replace them with words like gourd and pumpkin and cucumber. And so the gourd gives an emanation that is the cucumber. And then we call the following emanation the melon and so on. And so he's just having great fun with this because he's saying, when you think about this, it looks pretty silly, doesn't it? And he wants Christians to understand that. And to diffuse the danger of Gnosticism. What he wants people to know is they're just making it up and they're taking your money for it. So Valentinus is another one of those early villains who are working from within the church and then become parasites on the church because they're not about evangelizing the pagans. They're not about converting the world. They're about stealing souls away from the church. You know, they're just parasites, as I said.
Yeah.
And you know, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, what do you think are the most humorous villains? Are they from those inside the church or those that are outside the church?
Well, I'll tell you this. The three chapters that I read from my book when your friend Rob Corzine and I were doing the audio book of it. There were three chapters in which I was laughing so hard during the recording session that Rob had to say we'd better shut down for the day. And we had to do another day in the studio to make up for all my lost time. And they were the chapters on Nero, the chapter on Simon Magus, and the chapter on Nestorius, who was a much later heretic in the time of the fathers. Those three had me laughing so hard at my own jokes that I had to stop recording.
Well, that's the sign of a great book when the author is like entertained by, you know, his own writing. Seriously, I mean, you got good material if it cracks you up to the point where you can't do an audiobook. Okay, well, you brought up Nestorius. Yeah, now we got to talk about Nestorius.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a guy who just didn't have his head on straight. I mean, Nestorius was, from all accounts, a very pious and very intelligent monk. And he functioned pretty well within the monastery, right? Mm-hmm. Because there, he could be the smartest guy in the room, and everybody would just be impressed by him. And he wasn't challenged very much. So, you know, that was his reputation. His reputation reaches the capital city. The emperor needs a bishop for his capital city in the empire. And he says, I've heard about this guy named Nestorius. He's pretty smart. Let's bring him out here. And so they do. They bring Nestorius to the capital city. Well, a few things prove true almost immediately. One, Nestorius cannot get along with women. Okay. Huh. He had no practice with this, living in a monastery. He gets outside the monastery and he immediately alienates all the women in his cathedral church, right? Now, if you know anything about the church, the Christian church, you know that women are the engine of your church. It does not run very well if you alienate the women. And one of the women he alienates is the emperor's sister, who's a consecrated virgin. So Nestorius is doing all this, and then he really has his undoing, okay? Nestorius was a very verbally fussy man. You remember Felix Unger from The Odd Couple?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, very high-strung, very fussy about where everything should be placed, and Nestorius was a verbally fussy man, right? He was big on logic, and because of his real fetish for logic, he objected to the phrase Mother of God because here was his logic. You know, every mother must precede her child. No one precedes God. Therefore, God cannot have a mother. We cannot call her Mother of God. We should not, right? So he would say his favorite phrase was, strictly speaking, you know, she can't be mother. So there's a problem with this because the church has been calling Mary Mother of God since the beginning, and you can show it. You know, there's documentary evidence, at least from the early 200s, that the church addressed Mary in prayers as Mother of God. And even in the scriptures, she's called the Mother of my Lord, the Mother of my Lord, which functionally means the same thing. Yeah. So people pushed back. The common people pushed back hard because they were like, hey, my grandmother taught me these hymns. Are you saying my grandmother taught me, you know, heterodox faith? No. So he scrubs the hymnals of these hymns. He scrubs the prayer books of this phrase, Mother of God. And the people go and complain to the bishops in other places, most notably Alexandria and Rome. And those bishops are like, this isn't looking right, right? Something bad is going on over there. And so there's a lot of controversy. The people start mocking Nestorius. He has undermined his own authority by alienating the women and then shutting off popular piety. And the people start to make up songs about Nestorius. And all the songs have this phrase, strictly speaking, you know?
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
They mocked him. They mocked him. And so the people, it was just a bad scene. And it was, there were threats of riots and that sort of thing. So once again, the emperor calls a council of bishops in order to settle the matter and have peace and unity in the church. He calls it for Ephesus, which is a city associated with the final years of Our Lady's life on earth. Right. Yeah. And so, if we could spend a half hour talking about the Council of Ephesus and how the different factions tried to wait each other out and how the oldest bishops were dying in the summer heat. It's like something out of a story by Flannery O'Connor. You know, it's just grotesque. But in the end, the church, the bishops of the church judged that Nestorius was out of step with the way the church had prayed since the beginning, out of step with the tradition of the church that goes back to the apostles. And they showed in a documentary way the proof for that. They showed their math, so to speak. And what's really cool about the Council of Ephesus is that the common people waited outside the chambers where the bishops were meeting, and they waited in the heat of the hottest summer, record-breaking heat, and they were out there waiting for the decision. And when the bishops announced their decision, they carried the bishops through the streets of the city in a torchlight procession, and they sang Marian hymns, the ancient equivalent of Immaculate Mary and Hail Holy Queen. It's a great story. You know, yeah. Nestorius ends up looking the buffoon in the story, and he's eventually deposed then, and he's exiled from the territories, and he goes off to Persia, where he establishes a church which still endures today, but no longer holds his Christological heresies.
Interesting. Wow. I love this, Mike, because you really do make church history come alive. Where can people get your book, Villains of the Early Church?
Well, you know, it's available. This is it.
Yep,
it's available at all your favorite bookstores. I always say, if you have a Catholic bookstore, go there and order it. If you can't, go to Emmaus Road Press online. And if you absolutely can't find it there, go to Amazon.
All right. Very good. Thank you so much for coming on the program. This was a load of fun. All right. Mike Aquilina, folks. Great stuff. Pick up the book, Villains of the Early Church. And boy, this is the fastest hour in Catholic Talk Radio, I tell you. Coming up next, High Intensity Catholic Talk with the Terry and Jesse Show. And it's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center here and turn off the dojo lights. Thank you so much for listening to the program. And God willing, we'll talk again tomorrow. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic Audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.